Chapter 37. Miss R.P., with that repugnance to ostentation in dress which is so peculiar to her, was attired in a simple white lace collar, fastened with a neat pearl button solider. The fine contrast between the sparkling vivacity of her natural optic, and the steadfast attentiveness of her placid glass eye, was the subject of general and enthusiastic remark. Miss 150. B had her fine nose elegantly enameled, and the easy grace with which she blew it from time to time marked her as a cultivated and accomplished woman of the world. Its exquisitely modulated tone excited the admiration of all who had the happiness to hear it. About barbers, all things change except barbers, the ways of barbers, and the surroundings of barbers. These never change. What one experiences in a barber's shop the first time he enters one is what he always experiences in barber's shops afterward till the end of his days. I got shaved this morning as usual. A man approached the door from Jones Street as I approached it from Main, a thing that always happens. I hurried up, but it was of no use. He entered the door one little step ahead of me, and I followed in on his heels, and saw him take the only vacant chair, the one presided over by the best barber. It always happened so. I sat down, hoping that I might fall heir to the chair belonging to the better of the remaining two barbers, for he had already begun combing his man's hair, while his comrade was not yet quite done rubbing up and oiling his customer's locks. I watched the probabilities with strong interest. When I saw that number 2 was gaining on number 1, my interest grew to solicitude. When number 1 stopped a moment to make change on a bath ticket for a newcomer and lost ground in the race, my solicitude rose to anxiety. When number 1 caught up again, and both he and his comrade were pulling the towels away and brushing the powder from their customers' cheeks, and it was about an even thing which one would say next. First, my very breath stood still with the suspense. But when at the culminating moment number 1 stopped to pass a comb a couple of times through his customer's eyebrows, I saw that he had lost the race by a single instant, and I rose indignant and quitted the shop to keep from falling into the hands of number 2, for I have none of that enviable firmness that enables a man to look calmly into the eyes of a waiting barber and tell him he will wait for his fellow barber's chair. I stayed out 15 minutes, and then went back, hoping for better luck. Of course all the chairs were occupied now, and 4 men sat waiting, silent, unsociable, distraught, and looking bored, as men always do who are waiting their turn in a barber's shop. I sat down in one of the iron-armed compartments of an old sofa, and put in the time for a while reading the framed advertisements of all sorts of quack nostrums for dyeing and coloring the hair. Then I read the greasy names on the private barum bottles, read the names, and noted the numbers on the private shaving cups in the pigeonholes. Studied the stained and damaged cheap prints on the walls of battles, early presidents, and voluptuous recumbent sultanas, and the tiresome and everlasting young girl putting her grandfather's spectacles on, execrated in my heart the cheerful canary and the distracting parrot that few barbers' shops are without. Finally, I searched out the least dilapidated of last year's illustrated papers that littered the foul center table, and conned their unjustifiable misrepresentations of old forgotten events. At last my turn came. A voice said, "Next," and I surrendered to number 2, of course. It always happened so. I said meekly that I was in a hurry, and it affected him as strongly as if he had never heard it. He shoved up my head, and put a napkin under it. He plowed his fingers into my collar, and fixed a towel there. He explored my hair with his claws and suggested that it needed trimming. I said I did not want it trimmed. He explored again, and said it was pretty long for the present style, better have a little taken off. It needed it behind especially. I said I had had it cut only a week before. He yearned over it reflectively a moment, and then asked with a disparaging manner, "Who cut it?" I came back at him promptly with a wounded. I had him there. Then he fell to stirring up his lather, and regarding himself in the glass, stopping now and then to get close, and examine his chin critically, or inspect a pimple. Then he lathered one side of my face thoroughly, and was about to lather the other, when a dogfight attracted his attention, and he ran to the window and stayed, and sawed out, losing 2 shillings on the result in bets with the other barbers, a thing which gave me great satisfaction. He finished lathering, and then began to rub in the suds with his hand. He now began to sharpen his razor on an old suspender, and was delayed a good deal on account of a controversy about a cheap masquerade ball he had figured at the night before, in red cambric and bogus ermine, as some kind of a king. He was so gratified with being chaffed about some damsel whom he had smitten with his charms, that he used every means to continue the controversy, by pretending to be annoyed at the chaffings of his fellows. This matter begot more surveyings of himself in the glass, and he put down his razor, and brushed his hair with elaborate care, plastering an inverted arch of it down on his forehead, accomplishing an accurate arch behind, and brushing the 2 wings forward over his ears with nice exactness. In the meantime the lather was drying on my face, and apparently eating into my vitals. Now he began to shave, digging his fingers into my countenance, to stretch the skin and bundling, and tumbling my head this way, and that as convenience in shaving demanded. As long as he was on the tough sides of my face I did not suffer, but when he began to rake, and rip, and tug at my chin, the tears came. He now made a handle of my nose, to assist him shaving the corners of my upper lip, and it was by this bit of circumstantial evidence that I discovered that a part of his duties in the shop was to clean the kerosene lamps. I had often wondered in an indolent way whether the barbers did that, or whether it was the boss. About this time I was amusing myself trying to guess where he would be most likely to cut me this time, but he got ahead of me, and sliced me on the end of the chin, before I had got my mind made up. He immediately sharpened his razor, he might have done it before. I do not like a close shave, and would not let him go over me a second time. I tried to get him to put up his razor, dreading that he would make for the side of my chin, my pet tender spot, a place which a razor cannot touch twice without making trouble, but he said he only wanted to just smooth off one little roughness, and in the same moment he slipped his razor along the forbidden ground, and the dreaded pimple signs of a close shave rose up smarting, and answered to the call. Now he soaked his towel in bay rum, and slapped it all over my face nastily, slapped it over, as if a human being ever yet washed his face in that way. Then he dried it, by slapping with the dry part of the towel, as if a human being ever dried his face in such a fashion, but a barber seldom rubs you like a Christian. Next he poked Beirun into the cut place with his towel, then choked the wound with powdered starch, then soaked it with bay rum again, and would have gone on soaking and powdering it for vermore, no doubt, if I had not rebelled and begged off. He powdered my whole face now, straightened me up, and began to plow my hair thoughtfully with his hands. Then he suggested a shampoo, and said my hair needed it badly, very badly. I observed that I shampooed it myself very thoroughly in the bath yesterday. I had him again. He next recommended some of Smith's Hair Glorifier, and offered to sell me a bottle. I declined. He praised the new perfume, Jones Delight of the Toilet, and proposed to sell me some of that. I declined again. He tendered me a toothwash atrocity of his own invention, and when I declined offered to trade knives with me. He returned to business after the miscarriage of this last enterprise, sprinkled me all over, legs and all, greased my hair in defiance of my protest against it, rubbed and scrubbed a good deal of it out by the roots, and combed and brushed the rest, parting it behind, and plastering the eternal inverted arch of hair down on my forehead, and then, while combing my scant eyebrows and defiling them with pomade, strung out an account of the achievements of a 6-ounce black and tan terrier of his till I heard the whistles blow for noon, and knew I was 5 minutes too late for the train. Then he snatched away the towel, brushed it lightly about my face, passed his comb through my eyebrows once more, and gaily sang out next. This barber fell down and died of apoplexy 2 hours later. I am waiting over a day for my revenge. I am going to attend his funeral. Party cries in Ireland. Belfast is a peculiarly religious community. This may be said of the whole of the north of Ireland. About one half of the people are Protestants and the other half Catholics. Each party does all it can to make its own doctrines popular and draw the affections of the irreligious toward them. One hears constantly of the most touching instances of this zeal. A week ago a vast concourse of Catholics assembled at Armagh to dedicate a new cathedral, and when they started home again the roadways were lined with groups of meek and lowly Protestants who stoned them till all the region round about was marked with blood. I thought that only Catholics argued in that way, but it seems to be a mistake. Every man in the community is a missionary, and carries a brick to admonish the erring with. The law has tried to break this up, but not with perfect success. It has decreed that irritating, arty cries shall not be indulged in, and that persons uttering them shall be fined 40 shillings and costs. And so, in the police court reports every day, one sees these fines recorded. Last week a girl of 12 years old was fined the usual 40 shillings, and costs for proclaiming in the public streets that she was Protestant. The usual cry is, "To hell with the Pope," or "Oh hell with the Protestants," according to the utterer's system of salvation. One of Belfast's local jokes was very good. It referred to the uniform and inevitable fine of 40 shillings, and costs for uttering a party cry, and it is no economical fine for a poor man either, by the way. They say that a policeman found a drunken man lying on the ground, up a dark alley, entertaining himself with shouting, "To hell with! Oh hell with!" The officer smelt a fine, informers get half. "What's that you say? To hell with? To hell with who? To hell with what? Ah, bedded, ye can finish it yourself, it's too expansive for me." I think the seditious disposition, restrained by the economical instinct, is finely put in that. The facts concerning the recent resignation, Washington, December, 1867. I have resigned. The government appears to go on much the same, but there is a spoke out of its wheel, nevertheless. I was clerk of the Senate Committee on Conchology, and I have thrown up the position. I could see the plainest disposition on the part of the other members of the government to debar me from having any voice in the councils of the nation, and so I could no longer hold office and retain my self-respect. If I were to detail all the outrages that were heaped upon me during the 6 days that I was connected with the government in an official capacity, the narrative would fill a volume. They appointed me clerk of that committee on conchology, and then allowed me no amanuensis to play billiards with. I would have borne that, lonesome as it was, if I had met with that courtesy from the other members of the cabinet which was my due. But I did not. Whenever I observed that the head of a department was pursuing a wrong course, I laid down everything and went and tried to set him right, as it was my duty to do, and I never was thanked for it in a single instance. I went, with the best intentions in the world, to the Secretary of the Navy and said, "Sir, I cannot see that Admiral Farragut is doing anything but skirmishing around there in Europe, having a sort of picnic. Now, that may be all very well, but it does not exhibit itself to me in that light. If there is no fighting for him to do, let him come home. There is no use in a man having a whole fleet for a pleasure excursion. It is too expensive. Mind, I do not object to pleasure excursions for the naval officers, pleasure excursions that are in reason, pleasure excursions that are economical. Now, they might go down the Mississippi on a raft. You ought to have heard them storm. One would have supposed I had committed a crime of some kind. But I didn't mind. I said it was cheap, and full of Republican simplicity, and perfectly safe. I said that, for a tranquil pleasure excursion, there was nothing equal to a raft. Then the Secretary of the Navy asked me who I was, and when I told him I was connected with the government, he wanted to know in what capacity. I said that, without remarking upon the singularity of such a question, coming, as it did, from a member of that same government, I would inform him that I was clerk of the Senate Committee on Conchology. Then there was a fine storm. He finished by ordering me to leave the premises and give my attention strictly to my own business in future. My first impulse was to get him removed. However, that would harm others besides himself and do me no real good, and so I let him stay. I went next to the Secretary of War, who was not inclined to see me at all until he learned that I was connected with the government. If I had not been on important business, I suppose I could not have got in. I asked him for a light he was smoking at the time, and then I told him I had no fault to find with his defending the parole stipulations of General Lee and his comrades in arms, but that I could not approve of his method of fighting the Indians on the plains. I said he fought too scattering. He ought to get the Indians more together, get them together in some convenient place, where he could have provisions enough for both parties, and then have a general massacre. I said there was nothing so convincing to an Indian as a general massacre. If he could not approve of the massacre, I said the next surest thing for an Indian was soap and education. Soap and education are not as sudden as a massacre, but they are more deadly in the long run, because a half-massacred Indian may recover, but if you educate him and wash him, it is bound to finish him some time or other. It undermines his constitution. It strikes at the foundation of his being. I said, the time has come when blood-curdling cruelty has become necessary. Inflict soap and a spelling book on every Indian that ravages the plains, and let them die. The Secretary of War asked me if I was a member of the cabinet, and I said I was. He inquired what position I held, and I said I was clerk of the Senate Committee on Conchology. I was then ordered under arrest for contempt of court, and restrained of my liberty for the best part of the day. I almost resolved to be silent thenceforward, and let the government get along the best way it could. But duty called, and I obeyed. I called on the Secretary of the Treasury. He said, "What will you have?" The question threw me off my guard. I said, "Rum punch." He said, "Colin, if you have got any business here, sir, state it and in as few words as possible." I then said that I was sorry he had seen fit to change the subject so abruptly, because such conduct was very offensive to me, but under the circumstances I would overlook the matter and come to the point. I now went into an earnest expostulation with him upon the extravagant length of his report. I said it was expensive, unnecessary, and awkwardly constructed. There were no descriptive passages in it, no poetry, no sentiment, no heroes, no plot, no pictures, not even woodcuts. Nobody would read it, that was a clear case. I urged him not to ruin his reputation by getting out a thing like that. If he ever hoped to succeed in literature, he must throw more variety into his writings. He must beware of dry detail. I said that the main popularity of the almanac was derived from its poetry and conundrums, and that a few conundrums distributed around through his treasury report would help the sale of it more than all the internal revenue he could put into it. I said these things in the kindest spirit, and yet the Secretary of the Treasury fell into a violent passion. He even said I was an ass. He abused me in the most vindictive manner, and said that, if I came there again meddling with Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.